Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Carving It Up Live right here on Twitter, as well as the Carving It Up YouTube channel and the Grid Network YouTube channel. As always, I'm Bryson Carver. Very, very, very excited about today's show. We got all kinds of stuff. We got NFL draft stuff on today's show. The top 10, Bryson's best 10. It's Wednesday, so we got Carving Up the Context. We got Bryson's best 10. My top 10 number one NFL draft picks of all time. I'll rank that in about 45 to 50 minutes. Very excited about that. Also, Carving Up the Context, the Phoenix Suns are down 2-0, and they have only themselves, and in particular, their front office, to blame for what's going on right now at the hands of the young and hungry Minnesota Timberwolves. Getting to that in about 30 minutes. Carving Up the Context. Stay tuned for that. Also, He keeps doing it, and he keeps validating what I've been saying for years. Joel Embiid came up short again in a really big playoff game. More on that in about 15 minutes or so. Getting into that, no question about it. Also, into the show, why the Dallas Mavericks, who won last night, game two, to even up the series against the LA Clippers, 1-1 series goes back to Dallas later this week. Why the Dallas Mavericks are in position, and I believe they will win the rest of their games this series. I think this is going to be a gentleman's sweep. I had Dallas in five coming in, and I could not feel better about that prediction, especially after what I saw last night. Everybody, feel free to chime in the comment section. Looks like my man Patrick Brown has. He says, breaking news from the NFL. The Bengals franchise cornerstone players T. Higgins and Trey Hendrickson have both requested trades. Well, listen, that is, they paid Joe Burrow. They're going to pay Ja'Marr Chase. They just opted in Ja'Marr Chase's fifth-year option this year. And so, which obviously they were going to do that. He's a top five receiver in the league. But listen, this is what happens. Deal with some cap issues. T. Higgins is on a franchise tag, but this feels somewhat inevitable. The Trey Hendrickson thing, if I'm Cincinnati, I'd be more focused on locking him in than T. Higgins, because you already have a great receiver. Keep Hendrickson, who's obviously a really good pass rusher and, you know, cornerstones of an NFL franchise. Quarterbacks, left tackles, pass rushers. Then you start to get to receivers, stuff like that. So that's my my quick opinion on that. But first, this takes aging better by the day. So, you know, I said after game one between the Lakers and the Nuggets that LeBron James, who has often treated game ones the way that Bill Belichick and Tom Brady used to treat September, feel out process, we're going to win some, we're going to lose some, but really sort of kind of an extension of the preseason, or in LeBron's case, again, somewhat of an extension of the regular season, where feel the game out, probably the highest basketball IQ of all time, see what an opponent's got. But game one on Saturday was different. I felt like LeBron went attack mode. LeBron's got to pick his spots. He has 39 years of age at this point in his career, right? He's going to go attack mode, do what he's got to do, drop 19 the first half. 80's going to give you 17 the first half. You're going to be only up by three against a Denver Nuggets team where Jamal Murray's struggling. And at that point, I felt like LeBron's like, you know what? I'm going to pull back a little bit. I'm going to feel out the second half, see what matchups we can exploit in game two. If we win, great. If we don't, put all of our chips into the win game two on the road table. Because obviously the Lakers literally can't win the series unless they win a road game in Denver because they don't have home court advantage. And I actually thought the Lakers were going to win for that reason. I felt like LeBron was going to be good in stretches. AD would be productive. Denver would sort of let their foot off the gas pedal to a degree, right? You've beaten a team nine straight times. Like, it's tough to do it 10 straight, especially when the other team's really getting tired of that narrative. Lakers need to steal this game. They need it to a degree a lot more than Denver does, because Denver's obviously a better basketball team. And over the course of 48 minutes, I mean, just look down this list. I got some here in my notes, okay? LeBron drops 26, 12, and 8 with two steals and two blocks, including dropping 14 the fourth quarter. Everybody's crushing LeBron for that missed three. They're not even in the game if he doesn't drop 14 in the fourth quarter. Anthony Davis dropped 32 and 11. That'll work. D'Lo came out of nowhere. Man dropped 7 3-pointers. Well above his playoff average. I talked about that on Monday. You're not going to get much from D'Lo in this series, because you don't get much from D'Lo in general in the playoffs as a Laker. He's great. Dropped 21 points, 7 threes. Lakers went up 20 in the third quarter. Jamal Murray, and we'll get to Jamal in just a second, was awful through three quarters. 3 for 16. All of these things go in the Lakers' favor. They enter the fourth quarter up 10. And over the course of events we'll talk about in just a second, it culminated with this.
Tie ball game. Worst can happen. We go to overtime. Murray makes a move. There's a...
Won! Yeah, that happened. Obviously, a great call by the great Kevin Harlan, who's one of my five favorite announcers in the world. So, Jamal Murray hits a buzzer beater. Nuggets go home happy, go up 2-0 on the Lakers. So, listen, I said last week, last Monday, that the Lakers, given the path they you know had ahead of them in the playing game against New Orleans, if they lost, they'd have to face either Sacramento or Golden State, both of which who own them. I still believe either team would have beaten the Lakers, even though both missed the playoffs. If they beat the Pelicans, which they did, their reward, they get to face a team that literally owns them, the Denver Nuggets, who coming in had won 8 straight times and now won 10 straight. And again, the Lakers could not have possibly. Listen, we can talk about the fact that Anthony Davis went scoreless in the second half. We can talk about the fact that Darvin Ham, for reasons I'm not quite sure, decided to go away from the LeBron James Anthony Davis two-man game, which again is beyond me because the Nuggets couldn't stop it all night. More on sort of what Denver did to adjust to that in just a second. While Denver does what they always do. It's amazing. Every single, I was talking about this with my buddy Grady, who's a big Lakers fan. Shout out to Grady. We were talking about this. It's every single game looks alike. The only thing we haven't seen the last 10 games between the Lakers and the Nuggets is A, the Lakers win, and B, a blowout. Maybe the first game of the 10-game winning streak might have been a blowout. I don't know. But the last 9, I know for a fact, not blowouts. So you look at all those factors. You look at the fact that, again, LeBron, AD, didn't go to the high pick and roll. Again, I put most of that on Darvin Ham. You look at the fact that Michael Malone made one of the adjustments of the game and probably of the series, putting Aaron Gordon on Anthony Davis so that Jokic wouldn't get in foul trouble guarding AD. And more importantly, Jokic struggles at times. Jokic is an all-time great player, best player in basketball. But struggles at times, as most bigs do, guarding the perimeter. So Michael Malone says, no, we're not going to worry about that. We're going to put Aaron Gordon, who's big, strong, can hold his own against Anthony Davis. And if they set the screen, oh, he can. LeBron's going to get his. But he can take LeBron James one-on-one more than Jokic can. So props to Michael Malone for making that adjustment because he's an excellent head coach, and I've said so for years. I think he's one of the best in the NBA. But Lakers fans talking about officiating, which we'll get into, and they're talking about, well, Rui Hachimura had 3 points. Okay, if your fifth best player scoring 3 points while your best player drops 14 in the fourth quarter, that would be LeBron James. Your second best player by an inch was amazing. Again, bad in the fourth quarter, I get it, but was awesome through three. AD took you 3 quarters. LeBron took it in the fourth. Could not have been better between those two. You look at the fact that you got a guy in D'Angelo Russell who I'm willing to say right now will not play that well the rest of the series. I did a side-by-side D'Lo in game one versus D'Lo as a Laker. They're the same. D'Lo as a Laker in the playoffs. Same numbers. He's not good. He's great on Monday night. It didn't matter. Austin Reeves hit a shot late that was... Didn't matter because Denver's better. Denver's a better basketball team. Denver's got the best player in the series, the more reliable second star in the playoffs. Love AD. Jamal's more reliable, better playoff performer. They got the better coach. They got the better roster, better starting five. They're better in the clutch. Better. Why in God's name are we shocked that it's 2-0? I said Nuggets in five simply out of respect for LeBron because I don't want to see LeBron get swept back-to-back years. I may hate the Lakers as a Warriors fan. Love LeBron James. Love, you know, off the court, on the court, everything. But this feels like it's going to be a sweep because I thought coming in, Denver was going to win the 2 games in L.A. and that the Lakers, the one game they would get would be game 2. It feels like a sweep now. But for Jamal Murray, and you give him a ton of credit on this, and this is... We talk about playoff Jimmy. We talk about this guy stepping up, that guy stepping up. Jamal Murray steps up in the playoffs. And Jamal Murray, this is part of what makes this such a gut punch for the Lakers, is that through the first 7 quarters, Jamal Murray was abysmal. We could show you his numbers. First 7 quarters of the series and the fourth quarter Monday night in game 2. First 7 quarters, Jamal Murray had 28 points in 7 quarters on 12 for 40 shooting. Not great. Last quarter, 14 points, 6 for 8 from the field, and obviously the game winner, which put the Nuggets up 2-0 in the series. So Jamal Murray steps up. Jamal averaged like 32 a game last year in the Western Conference Finals. He steps up. How about Nikola Jokic? Okay. There were stretches of that game, certainly in the first half, where I'm like, I don't think Jokic is playing that well. You look at his stat line at the end, you're like, oh, let's see what. 27, 20, and 10. Because he's the best player in the world. With respect to Giannis and LeBron, AD, Steph, Embiid. We'll talk about Embiid later. He dang sure in the best player in the world. Whoever you want to throw out, Jokic's better than all of them. He's better than all of them right now. This, the idea, and I said this coming into the series, and I'm obviously it rings true today, and this is not a surprise. I'm not necessarily patting myself on the back because I thought it was pretty darn predictable. The idea that the Lakers had any shot to win four times in seven tries against the best team in basketball. I think Boston is the best roster in basketball, and I think the Celtics are going to go to the finals. The Nuggets have the best team in basketball. They're great late. You know, they're great in clutch. Get stops defensively down the stretch of games. This is what they do. And a final take on this game is one of my biggest pet peeves in all of sports and has been since the day I started the show, October 21st, 2019. It's always been one of my biggest pet peeves is when after a close game, comes down to the wire, crazy, you know, there's a game-winning play or whatever, fans, media, and in this case, players whine, cry, and moan about the officiating. And I love LeBron James. We can debate this another day. I think he's the greatest basketball player who ever lived. But this was LeBron after the game against Denver. Take a listen.
I don't understand what's going on in the replay center, to be honest. I think I said it this year or last year, whatever. D'Lo clearly gets hit in the face on a drive. What the do we have a replay center? Is going to go? It doesn't make sense to me. It makes no sense to me. It bothers me. Sorry I didn't answer your question, but that is like. And then I just saw what happened with the Sixers Nick game too. What are we doing?
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there. And again, love LeBron, but I hated that quote. And we deal with connection issues. See if we can get back on. For one, were there bad calls in this game? Was there a really bad miss when the referees went to replay the D'Angelo Russell play when he was hit in the face? Like that should not have been overturned. That was absolutely a foul. Was there a play late where LeBron James went for a layup, got hammered on the head, they didn't call it? Yes. And I'll talk about officiating a little bit later with Sixers and Knicks. The idea that that's what cost the Lakers. I mean, D'Angelo Russell tweeted after the game. Did we have the tweet? We don't have the tweet on the screen here for you, but I retweeted it and responded to it. D'Angelo Russell after the game against the Lakers. That's a foul. We all saw it on national television. Okay. Is this what you're clamoring to? What never ceases to amaze me about this is when, again, in this case, players, but fans, media, like, I've never seen the media do it as much as players and fans have in this instance, where they just neglect the other thousands of plays or possibilities or scenarios that happen throughout the duration of the basketball game and focus on just those few as if that happens, that dictates the outcome of the basketball game. I said this, my prime example is when there was the awful missed pass interference call, and it was awful. Between the Saints and the Rams, 2018 NFC Championship game. And it's like, oh, the Saints fans boycotted the Super Bowl and they robbed our team. Was it a missed call? Yes. Did you put yourself in that position for that call to dictate your loss? 1,000%. And that was the Lakers. So we're just going to neglect the fact that Anthony Davis did go scoreless the fourth quarter. We're going to neglect the fact that the Nuggets down 20 midway with about 5 minutes to go in the third quarter, enter the fourth quarter down 10. We're just going to neglect those stretch of the play. We're going to neglect the fact that Darvin Ham, after Mike Malone made his chess move of putting Aaron Gordon on Anthony Davis, didn't adjust because that's not what he does because he's a fun of the Mike Budenholzer tree. I mean, what are we doing here? Again, love LeBron. I love watching this guy in the postseason. But that's weak. D'Angelo Russell, man, that's weak. What are we talking about? Denver's better than you. they are. And the Lakers outplayed Denver through stretches of that game. They couldn't outplay them when it mattered most. Gave them their best punch, which is what makes it all the more demoralizing. It's not like Denver just stole it from you. You held up your own. You held up a pretty good fight yourself. But Denver's the better basketball team. They're the better basketball team coming in. They were better last year. Neither team made drastic changes to their roster. And you're seeing it happen again. So is the replay system flawed? Yeah, it's flawed. Is LeBron, I heard Nick Wright, who knows LeBron James personally, talk about, he said he had a conversation. LeBron is still fuming about that game one in 2018 against the Warriors where there was a bad block to charge call. I remember that game. I'm Warriors fan. I remember that play vividly. Was it a bad call? Yeah, but they were beating the Warriors. And then the Lakers were never going to beat the Denver Nuggets, ever. Listen, LeBron James, Etta James, Jesse James, it don't matter. Nuggets in five. To the comments. Patrick Brown, what's up? Happy Wednesday as well, NFL draftee. The suspense is slowly boiling over. Yes, it is. I have consumed more mock drafts over the last 48 hours than I care to admit to. But it's a lot of stuff going on. By the way, the Grid Network 2024 NFL Draft Live Reaction Show tomorrow night, 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific time, live on the Grid Network's YouTube channel and Twitter account. I'll be hosting. I'll be joined by Mike Guido, other content creators throughout the grid. Definitely be sure to check that out tomorrow night, 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific, Grid Network 2024 NFL Draft Live Reaction Show. Cannot wait to do it. We did it last year. I had a blast. I think it's going to be even better this year. Patrick, who's a Lakers fan, by the way, we have to play 48 minutes of basketball. Can't leave the door open for any remote chance. 45 minutes and the final three, they put the nail in the coffin. They did. And people got mad at Anthony Davis for not spending much time with the media, which, again, I'm big on, hey, you do your media, availability, appearances, whatnot, but it was kind of a, not a watershed moment, but it was like a, okay, yeah, that sums it up. Anthony Davis is sitting there, kind of slumped in his chair in the presser room. He's got the mic in his hands. Reporter asks, AD, what happened on that last possession? AD, Jamal Murray made a shot. Drops the mic and walks out. It's like, yeah, that's pretty much what happened. And again, Jamal Murray didn't hit that over D'Angelo Russell, who's about his size and height. He hit it over Anthony Davis, 6'10", 7-foot wingspan Anthony Davis. It's insane. It's an incredible shot. And it wasn't like Kawhi, like that shot where he, his momentum carrying him right, fade away. His form looked a lot like Kawhi's in 2019 when he beat Philadelphia in game seven. But obviously Kawhi's bounced about 1,006 times before it finally went in. That was just butter right down the pipe. And that was fun. Bryson's best 10 number one draft picks in NFL history coming up in about a half hour. One of them obviously is going to be in the list. His name is Peyton Manning out of the University of Tennessee. Go Vols. I saw Peyton was at the game on Monday night. He's obviously big supporter of all Denver sports, and he was there. I anticipate pretty excited about the ending of that game and crazy ending of basketball. And it was, I went on IG Live at 12:30 in the morning, East Coast time. After the game, like I had to get my reaction like out of my system before I went to bed, because that was just, it was hard to go to bed after that one, because it was as Ernie Johnson on TNT said after that game, he said that might have been the greatest doubleheader in the history of the NBA playoffs, and you'd be hard pressed to find one much better. Well, doubleheader, you ask. Well, the game before it, featuring another massive brand, the New York Knicks, who hosted the Philadelphia 76ers in game two. The Knicks won that basketball game. In game two to go up 2-0 in that series. And in a game where I thought Philly, throughout the overwhelming majority of that basketball game, completely outplayed New York. They lead by 5:30-ish seconds to go, and, well, here's what happened.
Lowry got the pick. DiVincenzo comes out of the pack. DiVincenzo finds Brunson. Great defense here from the Sixers. Brunson gets a prayer of a bounce. 2-point game. Maxey hits the deck. Hart takes it from him. Shot clock is off. DiVincenzo, no. Hartenstein with an offensive rebound. Another chance here. DiVincenzo. He's got it. The Knicks have the lead again.
Crazy inning. By the way, former Warrior Dante DiVincenzo. Should be noted. I really hate that we couldn't keep that guy, because he's been great for the Knicks this season. So there's a lot to unpack. So I'll start with that play, and then I'll go in the micro, like that play, that sequence, and then the macro, which is Joel Embiid. So the micro is, again, similar to the Lakers-Nuggets game. There's criticism of the officiating. the fact that after Jalen Brunson made the three, took a bounce and went in again, somewhat Kawhi style, again, to mention that play. The Sixers inbound, Tyrese Maxey has the ball. He obviously, we don't have the freeze frame, but there's freeze frames out there where his jersey is clearly grabbed by a couple of New York Knicks as he's bobbling the ball out of bounds to the to the right side, or you know, in the direction, fading out of bounds. And he's obviously fouled there. There's a couple of plays. The NBA two-minute report, which I personally hate. I don't like revisionist history. But, you know, there's a lot of pushing, tugging, grabbing over the course of that 15, 20-second stretch. As far as the fouling is concerned, was Tyrese Maxey fouled? Absolutely. I mean, you can watch the plays. Absolutely fouled. His jersey's grabbed. I mean, he's pulled to the left. Like, it's right there. Throughout the course of that game, and this is what we ask, all we ask of officials, I would rather you be consistent more so than get the call right. I'd rather you get the call right, most importantly, but in a general sense. But if you're consistent throughout the course of the game and you don't call a play that you didn't call throughout the first 47 and a half minutes, then what's your complaint? Because you go to the officials and say, this is why we call it all game for both teams. We've been fair. Whether they call it tight, whether they let them play, which obviously I think we all want them to let the players play, which is what we saw in this game and throughout the playoffs for that matter, really throughout most of the second half of the season, which I give NBA officials credit on that. But the Sixers are claiming, hey, Nick Nurse called timeout. Okay. Can we show you? You'll hear the sound again. We can show you one more time. Watch the left side of your screen. Watch Nick Nurse after Jalen Brunson makes this three. And when he sort of kind of makes a sign to call timeout. So this is the first few seconds of this play. Watch Nick Nurse, left side of your screen.
Lowry got the pick. DiVincenzo comes out of the pack. DiVincenzo finds Brunson. Great defense here from the Sixers. Brunson gets a prayer of a bounce. 2-point game. Maxey.
So if you watch, it was not really. It's sort of like when I often use school examples all the time. I don't know why, but it's like when, like, if you're a professor or a teacher and you're looking at your class and the one kid like raises their hand and they're like, Billy, what's your question? But Billy's actually like scratching his head. It's like, oh, it's kind of fooled. That's kind of what it was with Nick Nurse, who, by the way, I think is an exceptional coach. He claims that, hey, then I really like timeout, scream at the refs, timeout. At that point, we won't show the play again. But at that point, the ball's on the floor. Nobody has possession. And therefore, by rule, you can't call timeout if nobody has possession. Knicks get the loose ball. DiVincenzo misses three. Hartenstein gets the rebound. Then DiVincenzo cashes the second opportunity on that. So if the complaint is, hey, you didn't give us the timeout, here's what I will say to Nick Nurse. And by the way, to all NBA coaches, because this has really, women's basketball has exploded over the last couple of years, which I think is awesome. The product, I think we all agree, is significantly better than the men's game. Is it more entertaining, better coaching, better players? Point is that the thing about women's basketball, not about the sport as a whole, but this particular individual, that drives me insane is when Kim Mulkey is freaking on the court, like mid-play, not even trying to call timeout. Like, I remember there was a play when when LSU played Iowa in the rematch this year in the Elite Eight, when she is inside the three-point line coaching her players. It's like, Kim, get off the court. If I'm an NBA coach, I'm like, hey, if Kim Mulkey gonna get away with it, if I'm Nick Nurse, Tom Thibodeau, any playoff coach, if the refs don't see me, I'm going to run on the court. If I have to risk getting a technical, then I risk getting a technical. Get your butt on the court. Call timeout. Don't have shoot the balls. Timeout. Oh, shoot. No, nobody has possession. So that to me is a weak excuse by Philadelphia. Now for what I want to really get into. I'm going to take a drink of water for this. Joel Embiid. I think those that have watched the show long enough, and we appreciate anybody who has and anybody who's new to the show, knows that I have been more critical of Joel Embiid than most. For the record, in all fairness, I was the same way with Jokic. until he went on in a historically great playoff run last year, won the title, and I think he's the best player in the world at this point. Denver's in great position to potentially go back-to-back. I seem to have been, and it's increasing now in the national media, but I feel like I was the first on this to say, hey, guys, first MVP, only MVP not to make a conference finals. That feels somewhat notable. Guy consistently doesn't show up in the postseason. And listen, I talked about on Monday's show how Embiid was great in the first half, awful in the second half. And Sixers fans were like, hey, Bryson, Embiid, who was already hurt, had a bad knee, went down towards the end of the half. That's why he didn't play well in the second half. I'm like, wasn't that knee bothered in the first half? Wasn't he laboring at the end of the Heat game? It's interesting. The point of all that is that Embiid, who doesn't re-aggravate the injury, at least from what we saw, is in this basketball game, is balling out, showing up and showing out for the Philadelphia 76ers until he needed to. So Joel Embiid got an and-one in the fourth quarter with 4 minutes and 21 seconds left in the basketball game. Do I have that right? Yep. Embiid hit a 21-foot jumper, made a free throw. 4 minutes, 21 seconds left in the game. A lot of time. And at that point, folks, the Sixers are down by three. Embiid never scored again in the last 4 minutes. His teammate did. Tyrese Maxey, he came up really big. Hit some big shots. Put Philadelphia up by four with about a minute left. At that point, I'm thinking, oh, Philly's going to win this game. Embiid didn't show up, and even worse. Yeah, you know, before we can get to that, let's talk about Embiid in this series. Fourth quarter numbers, let's just say they're not terribly impressive. Joel Embiid in the fourth quarter, the first two games of this series against the Knicks. Joel Embiid is in the fourth quarter, is averaging 5.5 points per game on 11 shots, 0 rebounds, 0 blocks in 10 minutes per fourth quarter. So in 10 minutes of a 12-minute quarter, Embiid scores 5 points. He's made 2 fourth-quarter shots the entire series. He has yet to record a block or rebound. At 7'2" tall, that is embarrassing. And when you consider the fact that the Knicks, and I talked about this after game one, Brunson was inefficient. DiVincenzo was inefficient. Josh Hart was inefficient. Ananobi was fine, but not a huge focal point, at least in the offensive end. Jalen Brunson, who I've, over the past year, become a huge fan of, has been terrible in this series. Jalen Brunson, in this game, goes 8-for-29 for the field. The three you saw him hit in that clip right there, only 3-for-9, 1-for-6 from three-point range. So Jalen Brunson got 24 points on 29 shots. That ain't great. Still couldn't show up big. And with the Sixers, even if Embiid doesn't score, he could have made the play that would have ended the game in all, you know, essentially. So Brunson makes the three, cuts it to two. There's the scramble for the ball. Oh, it's going all over the place. DiVincenzo's got a great look for three. Bricks it. Embiid is in prime position to grab the rebound. And here comes Isaiah Hartenstein out of nowhere. While Embiid's boxing 6'4", 6'5", Josh Hart, big 6'10", 6'11", 7 feet. Isaiah Hartenstein comes out of nowhere, grabs the basketball, you know, kicks it out to DiVincenzo, who makes the three to put the Sixers up for good. Not to mention at the very end, Embiid missed the game tying three. So scoreless in the first fourth quarter, no rebounds or blocks in either fourth quarter, averaging 5 points a game on 2-for-11 shooting, and missed what probably would have been the game-winning rebound, because at that point, the Sixers are up by two with about 10 seconds left. If they make their free throws, the game is over and the series goes back to Philly tied at one apiece. That's Joel Embiid in the postseason. Well, he's hurt. He's always hurt. He's always hurt. The thing that folks who defend Embiid regarding his injuries and those like myself who criticize him for his playoff performance, we should all be able to come to the table and agree on one thing. Objectively, he's not a reliable player. He's not. Not in the playoffs. I think the Philadelphia 76ers can win a championship with Joel Embiid there, just not as their best player. It's the very reason I think LeBron James should consider going to Philadelphia this offseason. They've got the cap space. Daryl Morey is an aggressive GM. You got Embiid. You got Maxey, Kelly Oubre. You got Tobias Harris. I mean, that is a heck of a starting five. Nick Nurse coaching, who's won a championship. But if you're going to have to rely on that guy, number 21, you're not going anywhere. We have, this is now 7 playoffs worth of evidence of it. Gentlemen swept by Boston, round 2, 2018. Lost in game 7 to Toronto. Well, Kawhi hit the shot. Well, every other Raptor in that game was terrible. Siakam was bad. Lowry was bad. Danny Green didn't play well. Couldn't take advantage, despite the fact that you had prime Ben Simmons, and that was about the best we got out of Ben Simmons was 2019, but prime Ben Simmons, Jimmy Butler, J.J. Redick, you know, all those guys couldn't win game 7 over a lesser talented Raptors team. Got swept in the first round 2020. Lost a game 7 on your home floor against the Atlanta Hawks. Atlanta Hawks with Trae Young having a terrible shooting game. 2022, got bounced to 6 by a significantly lesser talented Miami Heat team. 2023, you got a 3-2 lead. Game 6 on your home floor. Tatum's playing awful, and you disappear in the fourth. And in game 7, you struggled. You failed to record 10 rebounds as a 7'2" big. That's Joel Embiid in the postseason. It's the old, I talk about all the time, where with great, truly great players, and Embiid's obviously that. He's an MVP. He's won 2 scoring titles. He's a great player. What we often ask as fans of our great players going into the playoffs, okay, you were great in the regular season. You were great over the course of an 82-game regular season. Just maintain that in the playoffs, and we're in good shape. We'll leave with the results. If you are in the postseason, the guy, same guy you are in the regular season, well, then we can't say you show up or overperform. You were who you were. Embiid consistently, just like his old running mate, James Harden, underperforms. And Embiid has never had a better set of circumstances surrounding him. He's got for the first time in his career, a reliable number 2 option, Tyrese Maxey. He's got Kelly Oubre, who's capable of going for 15 to 20 any given night. He's got Tobias Harris, who's capable of doing the same. He's got a good, long, good defensive team. He's got the best coach he's had in his career, Nick Nurse. And he gets a Knicks team that I did not think played well at all. Certainly offensively, the first 2 games of the series. Jalen Brunson, who I love, has been objectively awful through games 1 and 2. Embiid was nowhere to be found. Again, I cannot stress this enough. Embiid's played about 20 fourth quarter minutes through the first 2 games of the series. At 7'2" tall, he has yet to record a rebound. That's who he is. And by the way, was in prime position to get the biggest rebound of the night. And Isaiah Hartenstein, no offense to the kid, but he's not Joel Embiid, comes in, grabs the board. DiVincenzo hits the game-winning 3. I've been saying this for years. I've been one of the few, if not the only at this point, to say this, and it feels like people are finally coming to my side of the table. Embiid consistently plays down to his level that he plays at in the regular season. Well, he's hurt. Okay, well, he's hurt every playoffs. So at some point, we have to judge him for what he is and not what we're projecting him to be. Knicks are up 2-0. For the record, I think the Sixers are going to win the next 2 games. I do. Knicks are up 2-0. I think the Sixers are going to win the next 2. It's going to come back to New York. Madison Square Garden tied 2-2. And the Knicks are going to win the last 2 games of the series to win in 6, which I second the series. Knicks in 6. It rhymes. It feels good. They match up better. And that's how I think the series is going to play out. What you see with Joel Embiid historically in the playoffs is what you get. Jeff is in the comments. What's up, Jeff? Bro, who do you want your NFL team to draft the first round? Well, I am a Steelers fan, Jeff, so I am really, really high on Michael Penix Jr. I think he's the second best quarterback in the draft to Caleb Williams. Love him. If he's available, personally speaking, I'd take him. The Steelers, the report came out today, they're going to decline Justin Fields' 5th-year option, which I agree with. You obviously got a kid in Justin Fields who's got high upside, high talent. Not sure if he can reach his ceiling. He's not an accurate enough passer. And Russell Wilson is what he is. He's about the 19th best quarterback in the NFL at this point, which is better than what Pittsburgh had a year ago, which is why I was in favor of the move. And he's cheap. But yeah, I would I'd go offensive. Let's put it this way, Jeff. If the Steelers don't go Michael Penix Jr., if he falls to that, I go offensive line. Because if there's one general rule in the NFL draft, just about every single great offensive lineman in the history of the game of football was drafted in the first round. There's a few exceptions here and there, but by and large, that's the rule. Let's see. Jeff, oh, come on. That Raptors team went on to beat the Warriors for the championship. But let's be real. And again, I'm a Warriors fan, so I'm going to sound biased here, but I think we all agree. If I'm going to do you one better, let's say KD never plays a dribble in that series. Because everybody knows, if the Golden State Warriors are fully healthy, Toronto ain't beating them. Toronto probably gets a game, maybe two off them. They're not winning that series. I strongly believe if Klay Thompson does not go down in game six, I think it's a fact they win game six of that series. Because Klay went down, and if Steph Curry makes a three, they win the game. If they go to game seven in Toronto after Toronto's just blown a 3-1 lead, and Klay's healthy, Steph's healthy, I think they win that game. They may not, but... and by the way, folks forget Klay missed game three of that series as well. So he essentially missed five of the most important quarters of the Warriors season. That matters. He said, Jeff, Joel Embiid can be the best player on a championship team. He's hurt right now. Let's give him a break. Well, again, Jeff, this is who he's always been. And we can't judge. We're like, well, what if he's healthy? It's like Kawhi Leonard. Well, what if Kawhi's healthy? He's never healthy. 2020, he was hurt. 2021, he tore his ACL. He didn't play all of the next season, which is why the Clippers missed the playoffs. Last year, looks great, is balling out, and leaves with a meniscus injury. Misses the first game of this series. I'll talk about Dallas Clippers at the end of the show. Kawhi wasn't bad. Kawhi turned it up a little in the second half, but he's still working his way back. Why? Because his body is not that reliable. At some point, we have to understand that if your best player is not reliable physically, we can't trust him to lead you to a championship. I mean, look at the last few champions. Jokic, always reliable physically. Steph has had injuries, but when you need him most, Steph is reliable physically. Giannis, by and large, reliable physically. This year's kind of the exception. 2020, LeBron, that was still peak LeBron. 2020, reliable physically. Kawhi, 2019, again, that was pre-injuries. Let's see. Jeff says, yeah, true. I wonder why he's always hurt, though. There's got to be some way with conditioning that he can fix that. I think it's a combination of two things, Jeff. I think for one, and this some of this is not Joel Embiid's fault. It's the fact that he's 7 feet, 2 inches tall, probably, I'm going to guess, 280, 300 pounds. I mean, he's a large human being. Some of that is just, man, that's a lot of weight on those joints over the course of a long season. But some of that, listen, we've seen big centers. Shaquille O'Neal, didn't happen to Shaq in his prime. You know, didn't happen to Hakeem in his prime. Some of this also with Embiid is the fact that, again, he's literally, it's amazing as time goes on, he's literally the James Harden of centers, where Harden at his peak, you know, wouldn't play well in the postseason, but would be great in the regular season, despite, certainly not because of, but in spite of the fact that he came into just about every season out of shape. He'd be the first one of the strip club, last one to leave, closed down the bars, didn't eat particularly well, didn't commit to the defensive end of the floor, and eventually that caught up to him with when his athleticism failed him. That feels like Embiid. I don't think Embiid's athleticism is necessarily failing him, but because he didn't take care of his body at the early stages of his career, because he came into the season out of shape, time and time again throughout the years, that catches up to you. And I could argue it catches up to a guy that can be quicker at 7'2" than it does with Harden, who's about 6'4". So your body will treat you how you treat it. Like that's. I mean, Kareem, and by the way, Kareem played in a time where nutrition, all of that was very, very different than it was today. Very different. Like guys just, and again, by no, not necessarily any fault of their own, because it just wasn't as emphasized as much in Kareem's day as it is now, just didn't take care of their body as much as they did now. I mean, Michael Jordan smoked cigars, you know, but Kareem took outstanding care of his body. Played 20 years in the NBA, and most of them high-end years, and that's putting it mildly. He's won 6 MVPs, 6 championships. So to answer your question, Jeff, your body will treat you how you treat it, especially, I mean, particularly if you're a professional athlete more than anything, and it's catching up to Embiid. That's the reality, and that does fall on Embiid. That's why Steph's lasted a long time. That's why KD's lasted a long time. And LeBron taking awesome care of their bodies. And that matters. And that'll give you the longevity you're hoping for. Okay. Speaking of KD, that's a great transition. We're going to shift to game two yesterday. Phoenix Suns and the Minnesota Timberwolves. So this was a series I picked Phoenix to win in 6. And in order to do so, I picked Phoenix in 7. My bad. Phoenix in 7. And in order to do so, they got to beat Minnesota 4 out of 5 times. That, I'm not going to say it's impossible. It doesn't look terribly likely. So, carving up the context, it's a segment we do every Wednesday where it would be at a story, a game, whatever the case may be. I try to look just a little deeper than what what meets the eye immediately. So, as the head coach of the Colorado Buffaloes, primetime Deion Sanders says, give me my theme music. On this week's edition of Carving Up the Context, we're going to be talking about the 2024 Phoenix Suns, who were doomed from this offseason. And I said it then, I certainly say it today. Now, again, this is a classic example, assuming Minnesota goes on to win the series, which is not over. I'm not going to declare the Suns dead. Obviously, if they lose game 3, go down 3-0, it's over. No team's ever come back from a 3-0 deficit. This is a classic example. I've had many, many situations like this in the history of carving it up where long-term right, short-term wrong. Or you maybe could call it short-term wrong, long-term right, where I picked the Suns to win the series. I thought this is a situation where Karl Anthony Towns coming back from injury, you know, that we saw it. Brandon Ingram's coming back from injury, does not look good. Who else is coming back? Kawhi coming back from injury, you know, getting off to a slow start. It takes time to work your way back into the lineup. So I thought that was going to factor, and thus far it has, by the way. Kat has not been good in the series, even in the first two home games. I thought Rudy Gobert, that was a matchup that the Suns, just like every team that's ever played against Rudy Gobert in the playoffs, they could expose that mismatch. Just go to the pick and roll, get Rudy on the perimeter. He can't guard anybody, especially guys as talented as KD and Book are, and to a certain degree, Bradley Beal. I didn't trust Chris Finch in the playoffs. Vogel has his flaws, but I did like his playoff history more than Chris Finch's, so that's why I picked Phoenix in the series in 7. I thought Anthony Edwards would be the best player in the series, but ultimately KD and the matchups would favor the Phoenix Suns. Thus far, that has not been the case. Phoenix lost 105-93 last night to Minnesota, and none of the three stars for the Suns played well. KD scored only 18 points on 15 shots. D-Book, this was his good game, but he scored 20 on 6 for 13 shooting. Bradley Beal, 6 for 17 from the field, only 14 points. You look on the other side, Minnesota, Anthony Edwards was not good. 3 for 12 from the field. Cat was average. Jaden McDaniels showed up, showed out, 25 points, 10 for 17. He was, quite frankly, the best player on the floor last night. But the Phoenix Suns roster construction is what doomed them from the start. And it all started with the Bradley Beal trade. And it's ironic that I do a segment every playoffs for the NFL and the NBA about a week before the playoffs, where I look at all the teams that are going into the postseason and I say, what's the thing that's going to hinder them from winning the NBA championship? Now there's teams like the Miami Heat who don't have Jimmy Butler, when it's quite obvious. They don't have their best player. They don't have any chance. And then there's teams like Denver. Like, man, where's Denver's flaw? The Phoenix Suns' flaw that I said would hinder them from winning a championship, and what I said verbatim, sure could use Chris Paul. You're like, Bryson, Chris Paul, man, he's in year 19. He's old. He's a shell of himself. He's a pure point guard. I mean, 3 years ago, Chris Paul led the Phoenix Suns to the NBA Finals. Booker was probably the best player on that team, but they don't get there without CP3. And he led them to 65 wins the next year. And last year was a lesser version of himself, but pretty good. And you moved him with a slew of other players for Bradley Beal, who I've liked his whole career. Excellent score. Almost won the scoring title 1 year over Steph Curry. Like, guy can put the ball in the basket. But he's unreliable physically. He's a defensive liability. And they already have had a better version. Two better versions of Bradley Beal. Their names were Kevin Durant and Devin Booker. And throughout the offseason, they never addressed the point guard position. Also, too, it's not just roster construction that doomed the Phoenix Suns. It's the fact that they had an internal issue in the locker room the last 2 to 3 years prior to this one, where the head coach Monty Williams and the center DeAndre Ayton flatly did not jive. They just didn't get along. There were some issues there. And so it got to a point where after last season, it was like, okay, you're going to have to pick one or the other. The Suns elected to move both. So Monty Williams is fired, which I thought then, think now, was the wrong decision. I've defended Vogel in the past. I think he's a better option for the Lakers than what Darvin Ham is now. But he's not a better coach than Monty Williams, given what Monty's track record is. You talk about, oh, Detroit. Detroit's the worst team in basketball, okay? No, Phil Jackson couldn't fix that situation, okay? You fire Monty Williams, so that to me tells you, okay, so you're going to stick with the big man, DeAndre Ayton. No, we're going to trade him, too, for Yusuf Nurkic, who doesn't have close to the upside of DeAndre Ayton, isn't as healthy as DeAndre Ayton, isn't as good in the defensive end as DeAndre Ayton. Oh, by the way, we still don't have a point guard. Oh, by the way, our top three stars, KD, Book, and Beal, not terribly reliable physically. Now, this season, they played the vast majority of the second half of the year together. They were on the floor. But you know what the Suns were also, too? The worst, statistically, the worst fourth quarter team in basketball. Awful in the final 12 minutes. You know why? Because they don't have a guy to dribble the ball off the floor, run the offense. Funny, they have him. His name is Chris Paul. Dribble the ball off the floor, get guys in and out of sets, get everything set, ready to go. All right, we're going to run our best sets, get the best shot we can possibly get. Again, it isn't as if Phoenix was or were the Cavaliers, like the Cavs or the Magic more specifically. Magic could kind of use a Bradley Beal type guy, right? Just a guy who can, when the fit hits the shan, get a bucket. Like, we give the ball to Bradley Beal, get him in a good spot. He can hit a shot, stem the tide, keep us in the basketball game. Right now for the Magic, it's Paolo Banchero or bust. They don't really have much offense outside of that. Offense was not the Suns' problem at all. They have, you know, one of the greatest scorers we've ever seen in our lives, Kevin Durant. One of the best scorers of this generation, Devin Booker, who has a 70 burger on his resume. And they said, hey, Matt Ishbia, owner of the Suns, hey, let's get more scoring. Bad news, Matt Ishbia, this isn't NBA 2K. You don't just put the best scoring point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward, and big on your roster and say, hey, we're going to win the championship. Works in 2K24, doesn't work in the 2024 NBA playoffs. The real basketball. There's an actual way, there's a method to put an NBA roster together, and the Suns, from the jump, butchered it. Now they have almost no assets. I mean, the team they've got now, the team they're going to have, unless somebody take, you're not going to trade KD or Book. They're too great to do that. I mean, who are the suitors for Beal? He's getting up there in age. He struggled with injuries, especially the first part of this year, dealt with some ankle stuff. He's a liability defensively, not as efficient, still talented, but not as efficient offensively. Maybe there's a suitor, but what do you really get in return? And if you get a package in return, you'd want to turn into something else. What would you get with that? The Suns have boxed themselves in, and they have no one but themselves to blame for it. Listen, I thought the Suns were going to win this series. I didn't buy into Phoenix or Minnesota coming to the playoffs at all. Still really don't. But we got Jaden McDaniels going off on a team that was not well put together, also too, on the defensive end of the floor. You only have yourself to blame. So, again, look at the list of mistakes the Phoenix Suns made. The first was moving Chris Paul, one of the best. Listen, Chris Paul's old, but if you're an old-school point guard fan, Chris Paul's your guy. He can still dish it out, doesn't turn the ball over, can hit the occasional mid-range, stem the tide, make sure things are set and ready to go. You moved him for a lesser version of Devin Booker, who you already had. It's literally like having a, like if you're a kid and you have like a Buzz Lightyear toy, right? I used to have a Buzz Lightyear toy back in the day, right? Used to have fun with that thing. And that would be like if I went to a yard sale and got a used, kind of beat up Buzz Lightyear toy. What do I need it for? I've already got a better, younger one at home, less damaged. That's what the Suns did, getting Beal to go with Booker and KD. So the moving a pure point guard in CP3 for Bradley Beal, who you essentially already had, but a better version of in Book, not replacing Chris Paul with a pure point. They played Devin Booker at the point. Yeah, how'd that work? How many turnovers do you have against the Timberwolves? Devin Booker had 6 turnovers. And I don't fault him for it because that's not his position. Like, they're asking him to do something. I don't think maybe he did in high school or briefly at Kentucky. Devin Booker's not a point guard. He is the purest two guard, especially in the modern NBA with the 3-point shot you will find. No point guard, a lesser version of Book, did not address the defensive end of the floor at all. And in a beef between Monty Williams and DeAndre Ayton, when you were going to be forced to pick a side, those two cannot coexist any longer. Both talented guys, you said, hey, let's move both. What? Either keep Monty or keep DeAndre. Get rid of both of them? It's impulsive decision making by an owner who wanted to come in, right? And a lot of new owners do this, some successfully, most not. Matt Ishbia, billionaire, by billionaire standards, relatively young guy, comes in and says, yeah, I'm going to shake up the NBA world. I'm going to game the NBA system. I'm going to get Kevin Durant. Give up all our assets to get Kevin Durant, which I did then and still do defend. He's Kevin bleeping Durant. You move heaven and earth to get guys like that. But I'm going to construct my roster as if I'm on my GM on NBA 2K24. Buddy, doesn't work that way. Suns have themselves to blame. So, this week's edition of Carving Up the Context, the Phoenix Suns are in big, big trouble, have been from the jump, and they have nobody in the NBA but themselves to blame for them being in this predicament. That's what happens. I mean, you box yourself in. You can't fault anybody but yourself. Okay, so the NFL draft is this week. Heck, this week. It's tomorrow. And we do have an NFL draft live reaction show on the Grid Network tomorrow, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific time on this YouTube channel, the Grid Network's YouTube channel, and the Grid Network's Twitter account. We had a ton of fun last year. A ton of people were tuned in, chimed in the comments. It was an absolute blast. Had a fun time doing it. I have no doubt that it's going to be even better this year. We're going to have great guests, great draft evaluators, Mike Guido's chief among them, on the show tomorrow, 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific time, prior and during, throughout the first round of the 2024 NFL draft. Tune in tomorrow, once again, 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific, Grid Network 2024 NFL draft live reaction show. I had a blast last year. It's one of the funnest things I've been in the podcast content creation space for about 4.5 years now. It's one of the funnest experiences I've ever had. It was great. So tune in this time and you will not be disappointed. No question about that. But the draft is tomorrow. And every week we do a segment called Bryce's Best 10. So I'm like, okay, you know what? Tomorrow's the draft. Let's do something draft related. So what I decided to do is the top 10 number one overall picks in NFL history. So Caleb Williams go number one tomorrow to the Chicago Bears. There's fans of Caleb. I'm one of them. There's detractors and haters of Caleb. There are many. Doesn't seem like there's much people in between. There's either you love Caleb, hello, or you despise Caleb. But one thing's for sure, he's going to the Chicago Bears. I think he's going to be amazing. I could be wrong. Who knows? It's not exact science. What we will do today, though, is look at the guys who are objectively great number one overall picks, went on to have excellent careers and have success, whether it be with their team, whether it be with another team. We'll get into that throughout. So if we can get the background music on right now, do we have it? Background music, Bryson's Best 10. Here we go. The best 10 NFL players picked number one overall in the NFL draft. We'll start at number 10. At number 10, it is Myles Garrett. Myles Garrett, the 10th greatest number one pick in the history of the NFL draft. And here's why. So 2017 draft, number one out of Texas A&M. This guy, I may be a Steelers fan, but I can recognize greatness when I see it. TJ Watt still should have been DPOY. But point is, Myles Garrett is, in my estimation, physically the closest thing we've seen to Reggie White since the Minister of Defense himself. The guy is an absolute monster. Okay, we've seen double teams, triple teams. Heck, week one of this past NFL season, we saw him jump over the center for the Cincinnati Bengals to sack Joe Burrow. That's what this guy's capable of. He's athletic as any player on the field, offensively or defensively. He's fast. He's twitchy. He's probably the strongest player on the field. Just about every snap he plays out there. Absolute game wrecker for the Browns. Again, they took him 2017. Browns didn't win a single game that year, his rookie season. But as time's gone on, obviously, we've seen him develop into the player that he's fully capable of being out of Texas A&M. Myles Garrett, the 10th greatest number one NFL draft pick in history. To number nine, a guy who actually didn't have his greatest achievement with the team that drafted him, but I'll explain. At number nine, the 9th greatest number one pick of all time, Matthew Stafford. Matthew Stafford, the 9th greatest number one pick in the history of the NFL draft, and here's why. So you say, Bryson, wait a minute. The Lions took Stafford 2009. In 2009 at the University of Georgia, you're sitting up here and telling me he didn't even win his Super Bowl with them. Why is he number nine? Well, I'll tell you why. So Stafford made Pro Bowls in Detroit, didn't win a single playoff game, but individually speaking, Stafford, literally the first year he went to the LA Rams, he was hoisting the Lombardi Trophy. And a couple years later, just last year, when we thought, hey, could be washed. Nope, had a great season, great second half of the season. And the Rams, a couple bounces go their way against his old team, the Lions. Who knows? Maybe they go deep in the playoffs. But as for Detroit, this will, I always say there's always a winner and a loser of a quarterback team divorce. Thus far it's Stafford because he's got the ring, but this might be one of the most mutually beneficial trades I've ever seen in my life, where Stafford goes on to win a Super Bowl and is still an excellent quarterback. The Lions get a slew of draft picks. They've hit on almost all of them, and now they're probably the second best team in the NFC right now to the 49ers. Maybe the best. The Niners have lost pieces and will lose more potentially with Ayuk, but this guy, monster arm, deadly accurate by the numbers, one of the clutchest quarterbacks we've seen in the history of the NFL, certainly in the 21st century. Matthew Stafford, the ninth greatest number one overall pick in the history of the NFL draft. This one I think is going to be very controversial. At number eight, Eli Manning, not even the best Manning, is the eighth greatest number one NFL draft pick in the history of said draft, and here's why. So you're like, okay, Eli Manning, you're telling me only seven other number one overall picks were better than him. Well, I'll explain. Was Eli Manning the definition, through the vast majority of his career, the very definition of an average quarterback? Yep. Didn't make a ton of Pro Bowls. I don't think he has any NFL All-Pro team selections. I highly doubt it. But he didn't just win one Super Bowl. He won two Super Bowls with a historically great franchise. While they may not be great today, they're great historically in the New York Football Giants, and did so with two of the greatest playoff runs we'll ever see. So the Giants get in as the sixth seed at wild card round 2007. They beat the Bucks on the road, three seed Bucks. They go on the road to a stacked Dallas Cowboys team, beat Dallas, go on the road to Lambeau, Brett Favre, and retire Brett Favre as a Green Bay Packer. And then the gauntlet of them all, the 18-0 seemingly unbeatable New England Patriots, and Eli Manning, who had done nothing in his career at that point, outplays the MVP of the league, Tom Brady, the greatest quarterback ever, en route to winning the Super Bowl. 4 years later, they win the division by the skin of their teeth at 9-7. They beat the Falcons at home, go on the road to 15-1 Green Bay, who had the MVP Aaron Rodgers, and smoke the Packers in round two. They go on the road to San Francisco, beat the Niners in overtime, and then again, hello New England Patriots, hello Eli Manning outplaying Brady once again. Listen, there's a lot of debate. Is Eli a Hall of Famer? Is he not? I don't think there's a right answer to that question. My guess is he probably gets in, but again, two all-time great playoff runs for an all-time great franchise. Did he live up to being what the Giants had hoped to be? Long-term, no, but I don't know. Would you rather be really good for 15 years or average for 13 and awesome for two, and you get two rings out of it? My guess is that any NFL fan base would go with the latter. Eli Manning, the eighth greatest number one pick in the history of the NFL draft. At number seven, playing the same division as Eli, Troy Aikman. Troy Aikman, the seventh greatest number one overall draft pick in NFL history, and here's why. So Troy went number one, 1989, out of the University of California. Oh, yeah, UCLA, not University of California, UCLA. Listen, I think he's a fantastic broadcaster and was an excellent quarterback. I think he is just by hair, slightly overrated. Again, not in the sense that he's a bad quarterback or anything. He was an excellent quarterback, but kind of in a game manager type role. Let me put it this way about Troy. Was he capable of doing the things that other great quarterbacks were doing at that time? I think so. There's a reason he was the number one overall pick. Was there a reason the Cowboys maybe didn't rely on Troy as much? Yes, because they had Emmitt Smith, who's the all-time leading rusher in NFL history, and obviously the Great Wall of Dallas, Michael Irvin, the whole bit. But what we cannot not recognize about Troy Aikman, he's a Super Bowl MVP. He went to three Super Bowls. The Cowboys bludgeoned all three opponents, the Bills twice and my Steelers once in 1995, which is the last time the Cowboys forget win a Super Bowl. I've been to a conference title game. But listen, Troy will always hold a special place in Dallas' fans' hearts. Again, the connection, 8-88, Aikman to Michael Irvin, handoff between 8-22, Aikman to Emmitt Smith. Obviously, the great defenses that were in Dallas, Jimmy Johnson for the first two titles, Barry Switzer for the last one. Troy was an awesome leader, an awesome clutch quarterback, great. Again, people look at this as a negative. Game manager McTroy excelled in that role, got the ball in the right spots, didn't turn the football over, and was as efficient as any quarterback we've seen. Concussions got him at the end of his career, but Troy at his peak was a very good quarterback. Do I think he's top 10 all time? I can't put him there, but Troytman, no question. The seventh greatest number one pick in the history of the NFL draft. We're going way back here at number six, an all-time great running back. His name is Earl Campbell. Earl Campbell, the sixth greatest number one pick in the history of the NFL draft, and here's why. So Earl Campbell, again, played for a franchise that, well, not that it doesn't exist anymore. They just moved to Nashville, became the Tennessee Titans. Played for the Houston Oilers and was an MVP in the late 70s, I believe. Was an MVP running back. Was as physical of a running back as we've ever seen in the history of the draft. The guy would just run through a wall to get to where he needed to go. Obviously didn't win Super Bowls, and that was more of a running back dominated era. You kind of, in the 70s, 80s, you needed a great running back to be able to reach the heights you were capable of reaching. Now, not so much so, but listen, Earl Campbell, he's dealt with some health issues at, you know, at this stage of his life because of the hits that he took. But listen, the guy, listen, you couldn't, if I was built like Ray Lewis, can't say that I'd enjoy tackling Earl Campbell. The guy was a monster running up the middle, was an NFL MVP in the late 1970s. Earl Campbell, the sixth greatest number one overall pick in the history of the NFL draft. At number five, it is for my Pittsburgh Steelers, Terry Bradshaw. At number five, the fifth greatest number one pick in the history of the NFL draft. So Terry went number one overall, 1970, out of Louisiana Tech, I believe. Or no, was Louisiana Tech, Southern Miss, one of the two schools. I think it was Louisiana Tech. But listen, the guy was... as he put up some weird stats in Super Bowls. Like, if you look at some of Terry Bradshaw's Super Bowl stat lines, he had one Super Bowl where he completed like seven passes or something. It was a low number of completions and had a well over 200 yards passing. The guy was a gunslinger. He was a risk taker. But he led, we can argue, probably the first dynasty. You can argue the 60s Packers in the Super Bowl era fit into this. You can make that case. But the first great dynasty in the Super Bowl era, the 1970 Steelers, who went to four Super Bowls, won all four of them. He was the quarterback. You obviously had Lynn Swann. You had Franco Harris. You had great offensive lines in Pittsburgh. You had the Steel Curtain led by Mean Joe Green. You had plenty of great players on the Steelers teams, but they were led by the great Terry Bradshaw, who's obviously a hilarious broadcaster nowadays and has been for a long time with Fox. Listen, there's something to be said about going to the big game four times and winning all four times. Only Joe Montana can have a similar claim. But listen, Terry Bradshaw, gunslinger, not terribly efficient, but came up big when it mattered most, made all the big throws when he absolutely had to, and led the Steelers to four of their six Super Bowl titles. Terry Bradshaw, the fifth greatest number one overall pick in the history of the NFL draft. At number four, the greatest, I mean, statistically speaking, the greatest sack artist in NFL history, it is Bruce Smith. Bruce Smith, the fourth greatest number one overall draft pick in the history of the NFL draft, and here is why. So Bruce Smith, again, all-time leader in sacks, was the best player on a Bills team that went to four consecutive Super Bowls from 1991 to 1994. Four straight Super Bowls. And they didn't win a single one. That is, by the way, no teams ever went to four straight Super Bowls. Very few teams went to three in a row. Four in a row, unprecedented outside of the Buffalo Bills. It is amazing to me how you're good enough to go to four Super Bowls, can't win any of them, and in two of them, you got smashed. But the Cowboys, listen, it's by no fault of Bruce Smith. Okay, this guy got to the quarterback at a high level, sustained a very long career, which is very hard to do as a pass rusher. Not many can say that they did. Michael Strahan's one of those guys, Reggie White to a degree. That's very, very hard to do. But listen, all-time leader in sacks, was the best player in the team, went to four Super Bowls in a row. That's going to count for something out of Virginia Tech. Bruce Smith, the fourth greatest number one overall pick in the history of the NFL draft. At number three, it is John Elway. John Elway, the third greatest number one overall pick in the history of the NFL draft, and here's why. So he comes out of Stanford, 1983. The, at the time, Baltimore Colts had the number one overall pick. He and his dad said, hey, we're not going there. We refuse to play for Baltimore, and instead he ended up going to the Denver Broncos. And for years of his career, John Elway had the reputation of, man, he is amazing. I mean, probably the best pure passer in the NFL, great in the pocket, great leader, clutch, but he just doesn't win Super Bowls. I mean, John Elway had some Super Bowls, y'all, where he was horrible. Beyond horrible. Got destroyed in a lot of those games. Had one Super Bowl against Joe Montana, the Niners. The Broncos lost by a million points in that game. But to end his career, goes to back-to-back Super Bowls against the Packers and the MVP Brett Favre and the Atlanta Falcons. Caps his career with back-to-back Super Bowl titles. Plays pretty well in the last one. Plays very well. Has the iconic helicopter run in the game against Green Bay, which led them, obviously, to winning the Super Bowl that year in the late 90s. John Elway, to me, absolutely one of the five greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game. I'd argue I'd have him at number four, honestly. I put Brady right now, Manning. I'm sorry. Brady, Mahomes, Manning, and then I go John Elway. The guy was just absolutely gifted as a quarterback. John Elway, the third greatest number one overall pick in the history of the NFL draft. At number two, you can make a case he might be the greatest player at the history of his position. He is Orlando Pace. Orlando Pace, second greatest number one overall pick in the history of the NFL draft, and here's why. So he was drafted out of Ohio State, the Ohio State University, 1997. There's not really that many stats for offensive linemen the way there are for quarterbacks, receivers, running backs, pass rushers, linebackers, defensive back. But the guy was an absolute Mack truck at left tackle for those St. Louis Rams teams, obviously led by the great Kurt Warner. He was the left tackle. He was the anchor of the greatest show on turf, one of the greatest offenses we've ever seen. Obviously, the Rams went to two Super Bowls, won one against the Tennessee Titans by the skin of their teeth, and then lost 2 years later to the eventual dynasty New England Patriots. But Orlando Pace was, again, multi-time, I think three-time first-team All-Pros, two-time second-team All-Pro guy. Just made all-time great pass rushers look ordinary. The guy was as great as they came in his career. I believe the Chicago Bears. The guy was an absolute monster. Orlando Pace, maybe the greatest left tackle of all time. You could certainly make that case. The second greatest player to ever be drafted number one in the history of the NFL draft. And that, of course, leaves the man, the myth, the legend, the sheriff himself out of the University of Tennessee, Peyton Manning. Peyton Manning, the greatest number one overall draft pick in the history of the NFL draft, actually drafted a year after Orlando Pace in 1998. I don't even think I have to explain to you why. Peyton Manning, most MVPs ever. He has five of those things. He's got two Super Bowl trophies, a Super Bowl MVP in 2006, led the Colts to two Super Bowls, led the Broncos to two more Super Bowls. Listen, doesn't have the greatest postseason resume ever, but the regular seasons, and the, obviously eventually he did get one Super Bowl. Nearly got another against the New Orleans Saints. Obviously, yet Reggie Wayne ran the wrong route. Tracy Porter took it to the house to seal it for the Saints. Got housed by the Legion of Boom in Seattle in 2013. And 2 years later, in what was easily the worst year of Peyton Manning's career, but he had a great defense for the first time in a long time, and the Broncos capped Peyton's career off with a ring. I think he's absolutely, unequivocally, undebatedly one of the three greatest quarterbacks in the history of the game of football. I think Mahomes surpassed him with that Super Bowl a couple months ago, but I mean, the guy held every passing record when he retired, most MVPs. Mahomes may get five MVPs. That in and of itself is an unbelievable accomplishment. Peyton Manning, maybe the smartest quarterback at the line of scrimmage ever, accurate, didn't turn the ball over much, won a couple Super Bowls, won five league MVPs, and by the way, he played at the University of Tennessee. That doesn't factor in too much, but let's be honest, even if he played at freaking, I don't know, Cornbread State, he'd be the greatest number one overall pick in the history of the NFL draft. Shout out to Peyton Manning, no doubt about it. Before we go back through the list, or before we get to the comments, rather, let's go back through the list from 10 to 1, greatest number one overall picks ever. Myles Garrett, Matthew Stafford, Eli Manning, Troy Aikman, Earl Campbell, Terry Bradshaw, Bruce Smith, John Elway, Orlando Pace, and finally, Peyton Manning. Top 10 players to ever be drafted number one overall. Let's see. We got some comments up in here. John, Eli overrated or underrated? And John goes on to say, Eli's definitely a Hall of Famer. So I take it, John, you say underrated. Listen, I think Eli Manning is one of those few athletes. Maybe I'm reading the media wrong. Maybe I'm reading the narratives, incorrectly. I think it's properly rated. I think, gosh, I got something in my eye, guys. I apologize. Eli was, again, he had some good seasons, but by and large, pretty darn average quarterback. But man, in the playoffs, the guy was money. People say, oh, he only had two great playoff runs. Yeah, he had two Super Bowl runs, and he beat the Patriots both times. If not for Eli Manning, Tom Brady would have 9 rings. Okay, so, and again, you had the helmet catch in 07. David Tyree, Eli could have argued that they should have blown the play dead when he was wrapped up in the pocket. Obviously, I think for his history's sake, Patriots fans will disagree with me, but I'm glad they didn't blow the play dead. But breaks out of a sack, throws the play to David Tyree. It's kind of a desperation play. It was a third and long. People say, okay, well, lucky throw. Well, 4 years later, the throw to Mario Manningham down the sidelines to help beat the Patriots. Ain't nothing lucky about that throw. Absolute dime. One of the greatest throws of all time, certainly in Super Bowl history, to Mario Manningham to help the Giants beat the Patriots. But John, I would say properly rated. And if he gets in the Hall of Fame, I don't think you can put Eli Manning in on the first ballot. I think that's reserved for guys like his brother Peyton, like a lot of the guys you saw on this list. But should he get in the Hall of Fame? Yeah, he should get in. Not in the first ballot, but he should get in. Jeff says Trent Williams maybe over Orlando Pace. Definitely same tier. And I saw Jeff earlier said he was a 49ers fan. So obviously he's a big Trent Williams fan. But yeah, Trent is, again, is kind of the modern day Orlando Pace in many ways. Again, just a rock at left tackle. You don't have to ever worry about getting, if you're a quarterback in Trent Williams, your left tackle, your blind side, you're good. You are good from that side of the offensive line. So I mean, you can make a case for Trent Williams. You can. I put Orlando Pace just a hair above him, but you can make a case for Trent Williams, no question. And he says, great, great list. I appreciate that. Oh, he says, wait, where the hell is Jamarcus Russell? Well, you know, listen, a part of me thought about doing top 10 busts, but I'm like, Jamarcus Russell would probably top the list if we did top 10 busts. I'm not going to lie. He'd have to be there. But let's see. Do we have any? Looks like I got a lot of Twitter notifications. Any breaking news? Oh, okay. Naz Reid of the Minnesota Timberwolves has won the Sixth Man of the Year Award. Okay, so listen, Malik Monk would have been my vote. Part of that is just bias because I took Malik Monk coming into the season. But listen, Naz Reid, I was really hoping that my Warriors would sign Naz Reid last year in the offseason because I think he's an excellent pick. And Naz Reid always kills the Warriors every time they play. It really, really bothers me. But very, very deserving Sixth Man of the Year Award. Filled in quite well for Karl-Anthony Towns, helped to keep the Minnesota Timberwolves in that top three seeding when Kat was out. So listen, I have no issue with him winning that award. By the way, before we get into our last topic, and it is an NBA playoff topic, we do have two playoff games tonight. Yeah, two. So we got Miami, Boston, and Boston should win. I'll give Miami one home win in this series just out of respect for Eric Spoelstra and Heat culture, but no Jimmy Butler. Like they don't have a prayer's chance to beat Boston. And then you got Pelicans Thunder. I'm going to go Thunder close. OKC, they played their first playoff game. They're at home. They're going to be re-energized by that home crowd. They got out of jail, you know, by the skin of their teeth against New Orleans. McCollum Mobiles hit that game winner, but they got out. They're like, okay, because the average age of the Thunder is 23 years old. I think that's the average age of North Carolina men's basketball. So they're basically an old college basketball team playing in the NBA. And I think they'll settle in, take a deep breath. We've gotten our first playoff game out of the way. We won. We feel good about it. I think I'm not saying it's going to be a blowout, but I say Oklahoma City by 7 to 10 points tonight. That's what I got. And then Boston in blowout fashion against Miami. So basically what we saw in game one, expect to see that in game two. The Heat just don't have enough guys. They just don't. Finally, last topic. This has been a fun playoffs thus far, and it's hilarious that through the first, I think, 11 games of the NBA playoffs, we had every single home team win. It's like the old cliche, hey, the series doesn't start until the road team wins. Well, evidently the playoffs didn't start until until last night when we had Indiana beating Milwaukee. I strongly believe Indiana's going to beat Milwaukee in this series. I said if Giannis plays, which reportedly Giannis can't even run right now, if I'm Milwaukee, no, don't make the same mistake that the Warriors did with KD. Do not do that. I don't think they will, but if it gets dicey, if they're down 3-2, going to Indiana, do not risk that. And I think Giannis is going to leave this offseason. I've said that for a few weeks now. But the point of all that is, one of the road wins was the Dallas Mavericks over the Los Angeles Clippers. Kawhi Leonard came back in this game. Didn't play great, only scored 15 points. There's part of a reason he scored 15 points that we'll get into in just a second. But I picked Dallas in 5 in this series, and I still feel good about that. I think Dallas is going to win this series quickly. So game one was the classic. How many times do we see this in the NBA? You can argue this is what happened in Milwaukee in game one with the Pacers, who I think match up with Milwaukee, can score at will. The Bucks can't defend anybody. Neither can the Pacers, but the Bucks are arguably worse, at least against Indiana, is that, hey, you know, no Giannis – And you just neglect the fact that, hey, there's this guy, Damian Lillard, who can go for 35 and a half on you. Now, he didn't score in the second half, but he did all of his damage in the first half of that basketball game. That, to me, feels like what happened in Los Angeles between the Clippers and the Mavericks in game one, where, hey, Dallas is healthy, ready to go. Luka's balling, might win MVP. Kyrie's balling, and the Clippers are missing Kawhi Leonard. But you neglect the fact that, hey, Paul George is a bucket getter. Can play well on the defensive end. Russell Westbrook in a reduced role, pretty darn effective at this stage in his career. James Harden, while he is a playoff choker and will fade in the series, game ones he tends to be pretty good, as I showed statistically on Monday's show. So you lose game one in somewhat blowout fashion. But game two, whoo, Luka Doncic giving it to him. Luka Doncic against the Los Angeles Clippers last night in game two was killing. And by the way, Luka average has like playoff averages of 35 and 5. Only Michael Jordan can say that in NBA playoff history. So there you go. But Luka, 32, 9 and 6, 11 for 26 from the field, but balled out in the fourth quarter. Hit some dagger shots, some tough shots in the fourth quarter. My only criticism before I move to Luka individually, my only criticism of Dallas is I feel like to a degree, and I don't think it'll hurt them this series, but it could hurt them moving forward, because I think Dallas is the biggest threat to Denver out west, is that I feel like they go too much Luka-centric, where it's give, and the reason I say that, and it's a concern, is because over the second half of the season, when Dallas got really hot to vault from like the 8 seed to the 5 seed, is they kind of played a more up-tempo. Some of that's Kyrie. Kyrie's a very much up-tempo guy, can play off ball. They went more to that more so than they had in previous years with Luka. I feel like they've devolved back into that as of late in this series, but more so beyond this, because I do think Dallas is going to win this one quickly. I think they'll sweep the series at home and then close it out in game five in Los Angeles. But they do need to play more, you know, quickly, up-tempo, that sort of thing. But I want to talk about Luka on the defensive end briefly before we get out of here, because Luka's NBA comparison, it's really been two guys. It's been James Harden and Carmelo Anthony. Both at their peak, elite scorers, and liability doesn't even begin to describe those guys on the defensive end. Awful. Awful on the defensive end. That's been Luka through big stretches of his career. Not recently and not last night. So, Harden, who can score, not as well as he could, and it is the playoffs, so you do factor that in. But Harden, Paul George, who can score it well, so cool Kawhi Leonard, went 3 for 11 when Luka Doncic guarded them. The Clippers in totality, we can show you the numbers. The Clippers and Ty Lue, who's a great coach, top three in the NBA, said, you know what? We're going after Luka. That didn't work at all. Luka Doncic, when the Clippers, when guarded by Luka last night, scored 14 points on 6 of 24 from the field, 2 of 9 from three-point range. And you see that little asterisk down there. Kawhi, PG, and Harden combined, again, when they were facing Luka, went 3 for 11 from the field. So the three best offensive players for the Clippers basically couldn't score when Luka guarded them. And late in the fourth quarter, Luka put the clamps on. I mean, Kawhi Leonard is one of the strongest players in the NBA. Is on the right block or right baseline, backing down Luka, and Luka's not moving. I've never seen Kawhi Leonard try and back down a guy. And now there was some help defense that came late, but Luka not only held his own, locked up Kawhi on that play and down the stretch. And so, again, I've said for a few weeks now, I didn't buy into Dallas for majority of the season because I don't think the fit with Luka and Kyrie. Listen, when new data presents itself, you need to change your opinion. And that's what I've done with Dallas. They're much better defensively over the second half of the season. They've been, by win-loss record, one of the best teams in basketball outside of Denver and Boston. And here they are, 1-1, stole home court against the Clippers. And I don't think they're going to lose again the rest of the series. And that Dallas-Oklahoma City, assuming Oklahoma City takes care of New Orleans in the series they're playing, that is going to be an interesting one. Because Dallas, Luka's never won a title, but has amazing playoff numbers. And OKC, who probably has a more talented young roster with so much potential for years to come. You know, when they're facing a guy who's been there and done that, it's a little different. Kyrie himself. Kyrie is the number one in the playoffs. Is terrible. Is terrible. Doesn't win anything. But when he's the number two, he's pretty good. Outside of the Brooklyn years, he's pretty good. So I feel pretty good about Dallas as the number two threat to the Denver Nuggets in the Western Conference. So, impressive win by Dallas, and they trailed through large portions of that basketball game. But Luka did Luka things because he owns the Clippers and did what we're not accustomed to seeing Luka doing, which is, man, play lockdown defense. Last comment before we get out of here. Jeff, if Jokic goes back-to-back here and wins finals MVP, does that arguably make him a top 10 player of all time? Not yet. Here's what I think, Jeff. To me, he absolutely moves him to the top 15. You can't have a guy with two championships and two championships, presumably two finals MVPs, unless Jamal Murray has a great series, which is possible. And we think it's probably going to get announced 2 weeks from now. We think a couple of MVPs. You can't tell me that guy's not one of the 15 greatest basketball players ever. And for the record, as I talked about in the Embiid segment, I was a skeptic on Jokic because he had a rough last 2 years in the playoffs prior to last year. But when he put together that run, and Denver lost, I think, four games combined in the postseason, give respect where it's due. Doing what he's doing this year, not top 10 yet. But he's starting to, he's not knocking on the door yet, but he's walking up the sidewalk, okay? He was driving up the cul-de-sac last year. He's walking up the sidewalk this year. And if he wins, if he three-peats, oh, he's got to be in the top 10 at that point. But yeah, Jokic, to me with the title, Jeff, and assuming he wins MVP this year, which if I had a vote, he would be my MVP, he would have to be top 15 all time. But there you go. All right. That is all the time we have for today's show. I appreciate everybody stopping by. As always, be sure to catch Carving It Up Live on Friday. Boy, will we have a lot to talk about then. At 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific time, right here on Twitter, as well as the Carving It Up YouTube channel and the Grid Network YouTube channel. And of course, be sure to like, share, comment, and please take 2 seconds out of your day. Hit that big red subscribe button down there. It would help the channel grow exponentially. We're trying to get to 1,000 subscribers. We are getting close. Last I checked, I think we're at like 959. So we are inching closer towards 1K. So if you have subscribed, thank you, thank you, thank you so much. If you have not subscribed, please tell please subscribe and also tell your friends and family about it. Even if you have subscribed, please do the same. Just do me a favor. Don't tell your sleeping cat about it. I tried to talk to my cat today, this morning, when he was sleeping. He was not having it. He was not having it. But shout out to Neyland. He's our orange tabby cat because he's, you know, Neyland Stadium, Tennessee. Like it works. Shout out to Neyland. Gotta give Neyland a shout out on the show. Also, just as importantly, be sure to go subscribe to the Grid Network. That is GRYD, the Grid Podcast Network, right here on YouTube, as well as any and everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, any and everywhere you get your favorite podcasts. You could check us out on the Grid. Tomorrow, the Grid Network 2024 NFL Draft live reaction show. I'll be hosting. I'll be joined by a myriad of guest contributors and content creators alike. You will not, I promise you, you will not want to miss that show. Cannot wait to see everybody in the comment section tuning in like we saw a year ago and reacting to what's going to be a blast in the NFL draft. And in just 37 minutes, the 8 o'clock spot, the Grid Network's game show. Grid Network's game show. We're going to be talking NBA playoffs, NFL draft. Mike Guido's going to be a part of it. Eric, Keith, both of which have been on the 8 o'clock spot in the last few weeks, but I'm the host / judge / moderator. It's a Grid Network. It's a sports game show. Grid Network, 8 o'clock spot live in literally just over a half hour. So definitely be sure to tune into that if you can. All right. I will see y'all on the 8 o'clock spot in 30, the Grid's draft show tomorrow, and Carving It Up on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific time on Twitter, as well as the Carving It Up YouTube channel and the Grid Network YouTube channel. Very excited to see everybody there and have a great time as always. All right, please be sure to stay safe out there. Please be sure to take care of your physical as well as your mental health. And please, 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 as I say every show, because it means so much to me, please contact your local state representatives and senators to demand change for gun violence in America, no matter where you lean. Right, left, center. This is an issue that affects every single one of us. And no matter what anybody on either side tries to gaslight us and say there's one solution or there's multiple different ways we can address this issue, let's come together. Let's do what we got to do do our civic duty to vote, to contact our state representatives and senators to demand change for gun violence in America. All right, I will see y'all in a half hour tomorrow at 7:30 for the draft show. Definitely tune in for that. And Carving It Up on Friday at 6 Eastern. So we will see you then. Stay safe out there, y'all. God bless y'all. Peace out. Come on, Steelers. Pull through for me. I know you know what you're going to do here. Come on, Steelers. Thanks so much for watching the show on YouTube. And be sure to go click that big red subscribe button and check out the other clips and full shows from Carving It Up Live, as well as our other incredible content creators here on the Grid Network.